Great to see everybody here. See, it looks like everybody's here. Maybe people got the wrong message. I'm not talking about Pesach until next week. So, but it's great. Everybody's here tonight. It's wonderful to see all of you. Hope everybody is doing well. Thank you for your well wishes for the wedding that we had last week. It was really, Baruch Hashem, a beautiful, beautiful wedding to see our daughter marry this wonderful young man. We're very excited to have him in the family. And my hope and my blessing is that for all of us, that we have the opportunity to celebrate good occasions, happy occasions together in good health for many, many years to come.
Amen.
Okay. That being said, I want to talk about a mitzvah tonight, just as last time we spoke about a mitzvah that was not necessarily room specific. We talked about paying our workers on time. Tonight is a similar concept, although it's more likely that we would perform this mitzvah probably in our living room. It'd probably be where it would be. And that is the mitzvah of tzedakah, the mitzvah of giving tzedakah. And at first I was very torn because I said to myself, everybody knows what that mitzvah is. I'm not going to tell you this new concept like, a railing around your porch or the first 3 years of a fruit tree or things of paying workers on time. But everybody knows the mitzvah of tzedakah. What could I possibly share with you? So I decided I would write down some notes and see if there were some things that maybe you're not aware of. And I think that I think it's worthy of a discussion because while we may know about it in a general sense, I think if we delve and dig a little bit deeper, there's really a lot more that can and should be said about it. Let me start with a simple perspective. How powerful is this mitzvah of tzedakah? Now, I'll use the English word charity, although it's not a great translation. We'll talk about that shortly.
Yeah,
But that's the mitzvah I'm
no.
referring to. How powerful of a mitzvah is it for real? I'll
Poor
give you a
world
very simple
society.
perspective. The
It's
simple
trusting our Lord.
perspective is that we go ahead on our holiest days of the year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in one of the most stirring prayers of the entire liturgy, the entire service. It's in the Musaf prayer. Is the one that starts with Unesane Tokef. That's what it's called. In many, many, many synagogues around the world, it is one of the most emotionally charged prayer where it talks about the essence of the day. That on Rosh Hashanah, the decree is signed. And on Yom Kippur, it is sealed. And we are asking God for life and all these important things that we want in life. But then we reach a certain crescendo and we say, Utsheshuva, Utsefila, Utsedaka, Ma'avirines Roa. Repentance, prayer, and tzedakah remove the evil of the decree. Does that sound vaguely familiar? Hopefully, my rendition of it was at least clear. It's an extremely powerful prayer. Where think about it. It's in the top three things that change a person's fortune. Teshuva, repentance, that makes a lot of sense. Repentance is where you do great introspection. You recognize some flaws that you may have and change. You commit to change. You repent of what it is you've done. To me, that makes a lot of sense. That can change everything. That is what being a human being and having free will is all about, that we can change. We are not forced into our destiny, but rather we choose our destiny. So that one I get. That can annul anything. Prayer, well, we know that. Prayer is where I turn to the one who can make that change, the one who I can turn to and ask for mercy. Prayer, I get it. But not to sound heretical, tzedakah is a nice thing. Don't get me wrong. It's an important concept of where I'm going to reach out and help somebody. But that it should be so powerful that it could change, even if a person, God forbid, God has decided that based on a person's behavior, they don't deserve to live another year. My giving tzedakah can change that. That's how powerful the mitzvah of tzedakah really is. In fact, the Talmud says, Shekula tzedakah keneged kol mitzvah, that the mitzvah of tzedakah is equivalent to all the mitzvahs in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty up there. Why? What is so unique and how do we perform it are the questions I'd like to deal with tonight. Let's start with a basic concept. What does the word tzedakah mean? We use it all the time, but what does it really mean? As I mentioned, in many, many circles, they translate it in English as charity. Anybody know where charity, where the word comes from? Give me what language it comes from, even.
Latin, caritas.
That is correct. It comes from Latin. Correct. And what does it, what's the root of the word?
Caritas.
Caritas, that is correct.
From heart, and thank my my father, blessed memory, Gil Rubinstein on his George side, who made all of his kids have 3 years of Latin.
Oy vey. But caritas, what does the word caritas mean? It means love.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It means love. So when you put it together, in fact, that's where the idea in Greek, philo, right? Like we say philanthropy. Philo in Greek also means love. Throp or T-H-R-O-P in Greek means man. Anthropology, right? You have all these different words that end with that because it's about man. So when you look at the word philanthropy, means love of man. It's for the love of man, which on the surface makes a lot of sense because charity, that same word, which is related and similar to French, chéri, mon chéri, right? You go ahead and you say my love. That's what, it's the same concept, but here's the flaw in the logic. If I am going to base my giving of my resources, which is what my money is, those are my resources, because I'm doing it out of my love for another human being, then what happens when it's not somebody I love? Or it's somebody who ticks me off, or somebody that is foul smelling, foul looking, is somebody that just I don't feel the love for. If you base your giving of your resources based on the love of another, then you will hit a roadblock. You will hit some kind of snag when you don't necessarily love the person. Which is why the word tzedakah is not properly translated as charity. The word tzedakah in Hebrew comes from the word tzedek. Tzedek, or the word tzaddik. Somebody who is a tzaddik. What does that mean?
A righteous person.
Righteous. The word tzedek means righteousness. It's the right thing to do. Not because I love him. Not because he won me over. But there's an absolute need. It's the right thing to do to help the person out. That's it. The person is not my friend. The person is foul looking, foul smelling, has been around the neighborhood too many times. But if there's a legitimate need, then it is tzedek. It's the right thing. It's righteous. It's the right thing to do, to go ahead and to give. It's justice. Very often in some circles, they'll translate the word that comes from the Torah, tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice shall you pursue. Alan, don't think I didn't notice. I noticed. That's where the word tzedakah comes from, because it's the right thing to do. Again, I know we've spoken about the concept before. When we talk about things that we're A mitzvah. Let's talk about the word mitzvah. What's a good translation for mitzvah, Sid?
Good deed.
What do you say, Sid? What does the word mitzvah mean?
Obligation.
Yeah, is it an obligation?
An obligation, okay.
Command.
A blessing.
Commandment. Blessing. That's a more precise translation.
Blessing. Blessing.
Mitzvah means commandment. That's really what it means. Obviously, therefore, there's obligations and responsibilities because if I'm told to do something or not to do something, it's my responsibility to do it or not do it. But as I've mentioned in the past, the translation some people use for mitzvah is good deed. I'm not a fan of it. I'm not a fan of that translation because of the same concept. Why am I doing this mitzvah? Not because I see necessarily it's a good thing to do. What if I don't see the benefit in it? How does my putting on tefillin every morning, how does that benefit you? Where's the good deed that's being done? Whose life other than mine is being impacted by my putting on tefillin or wearing tzitzis or even keeping Shabbos or kosher? Some of the big mitzvahs, and who is that? Who's it a good deed for? If you leave it to mankind to determine to do something or not do something based on how I perceive it, I see the benefit in it, then you will ultimately not do certain things we're asked to do or do things that we're asked not to do because I see it a little differently. That's the risk we run. If you translate mitzvah as a commandment, the same way that a soldier is given a command by his commanding officer, he may not understand it. He may even think it's not the right thing to do, but he will be thrown out on his head if he goes ahead and he doesn't do it, or he goes against the order. The word mitzvah means commanded, commandment, which means there's a commander. My job is to try to understand to the best of my ability. I quote this all the time, and it's worthy. Abraham, we know the biggest challenge he faced was the binding of Isaac, his son. According to most commentators, it was the 10th of 10 tests. He passes all of them. And what happens? And what happens? God says, you did a great thing here. You're a God-fearing individual. That's what the angel God sends after Abraham is stopped from actually slaughtering his son. The angel says to him, Ata yadati, now I know that you're a God-fearing man. What do you mean, now you know? Where you been for the first 9 tests? He's been doing this for a long, long time. Now you first know? To appreciate this answer, and you'll know the answer because we're really, that's the topic, the theme of what we're saying, is that I will argue and say that one of the earlier tests was even more difficult. Why? Because one of the first tests that Abraham faced was where the king Nimrod threatened him and said, you have to stop spewing this crazy concept of monotheism. Stop telling the people about this. We believe in polytheism, where pagan worships, that's the theme of our era. How dare you come along? And I'm going to throw you into the furnace if you continue spouting such terrible ideology. And Abraham says, no, I'm going to keep going. And he's thrown into the furnace and miraculously he's saved. Okay. I asked this question many times. Which was more difficult of a challenge for Abraham? Being thrown into the furnace or sacrificing or potentially sacrificing his son? Most people would say, well, sacrificing your son because that's a bigger challenge. I would argue the other way.
Thrown into the furnace.
Why?
Because it was the first challenge, so he didn't know whether God was going to be
his son. Exactly. Thank you, Sharon. That means you paid attention. Very beautiful. By that challenge, God had never spoken to Abraham yet. The concept of monotheism, that there's one God who oversees the world, was a theory. That's all it was. He had no proof of concept yet. God had not spoken to him. And he's willing to give it all away. I would argue and say that the binding of Isaac, God had spoken to him numerous times. He knew God was real. It's okay. If the God, the master of the universe, came to me and said, hey, Tachman, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, I wouldn't be like, well, I don't know. Let me think about it. Let me check with my Wednesday night group. Let me see what they think. If I knew this was God, it would be done, finished, end of conversation. So I would argue and say that the first test was harder than the last test, but I'd be wrong. I'd be 100% wrong. And it's because of this reason. While it's true that the challenge of the first one was still a theory and he was willing to do it, it made logical sense to him. If my theory is true, that there is one God in this world and we are here to do God's will, then it makes sense if you follow it to its logical conclusion that I'd even have to be willing to give up my life for this belief. That makes sense in the human brain. We know people who do this of many different religions. It's a concept that many people can wrap their head around. It's a logical corollary of my belief. But the concept of binding and slaughtering his son was the most illogical thing that anyone could have been asked to do, especially in this circumstance. God had promised Abraham that through Isaac, he will form a nation. Through Isaac, he's going to become the father of many nations, a huge nation. Promised him great. This is the only child for him. But if I were asked to do that, I would raise my hand and say, that makes no sense. There's no way I could have heard that. That can't be what God asked me to do. Yeah. Everything about what Abraham had spent his life teaching. God doesn't want child sacrifices. God is a merciful God. And now you want me to go slaughter my own kid? That's illogical. It's counterintuitive to everything you promised me, to everything I believe in. That was the ultimate challenge. Who's going to win out, Abraham? Because I, God, commanded you to do it, or because you don't see the logic in it? Which one's going to win out? That's a hard challenge. That's a really hard challenge. And Abraham passed it. He said, if this is what God, I don't know the answer to the questions why. I don't know why. But if this is what I'm commanded, I'll do it. That's why at the end of that test, God says, now I know you're truly a God-fearing individual. You're not going to let your human comprehension dictate what's right and wrong. That can't be the final arbiter. If this is a command from God, yes, use your human intelligence to try to understand it. But there may come a time where you don't. Are you going to go against the commander's orders, or are you going to go with it? If you go ahead and you determine that the doing of a mitzvah, and in our case tonight, specifically about giving tzedakah, that it's based on how I feel about it, whether I think this person is nice or I love the person, then you won't be doing the right thing. You won't be doing righteousness. You'll be doing what makes you feel good. I got nothing against it, but that's not the game. That's not the goal. Tzedakah means it's the right thing to do. Now, you say, okay, what if it's somebody? I know a true story of a fellow that was raising money, went to go see somebody, and the rich man, we'll call him, he went ahead and he absolutely cursed out this guy. How dare you come to me? I don't support causes like this. He absolutely ripped him, cursed him out, insulted him. The fellow kept his cool and he thanked him for his time and he started to walk out. The rich man called him back and he says, you have no response? That's it? That's it? You're just going to walk away from all of this? He said, listen, I'm sorry you don't see the benefit and stuff, but I know I have a worthy cause. I'll raise the money from somewhere else, but I appreciate your time. He kept his cool the whole time. Very much. The fellow said, well done. well done. I wanted to see. I really wanted to see if you would, you know, strike back at me. If you would insult me back and give me a hard time for how dare you treat another person like this. You kept your calm. Good for you. I see that it's a matter of you have the right ideals, the right ethic. And he wrote out a nice significant check. I know the fella to whom this happened. If you base it on how someone treats you, well, I'm not going to give him. He's how dare he interrupt me? Then it's not, you're not doing it out of righteousness. You're doing it because either you love him or you don't. And that's not the way we do things. Now, you can legitimately say to me, Rabbi, it's a beautiful concept. It's warm. It's fuzzy. It makes me feel good all over. Let the guy go to work. Stop dealing with handouts. Go to work. They joke in the yeshiva world. They joke and they say that, you know, there's 24 books in Tanakh, 24 books in what we call the Torah Bible. 24 books. One of them is known as Eov. In English, it's called Job. You guys ever hear of that one? Very difficult. Very, very difficult book. I do not profess to really understand it. However, the joke goes that most yeshiva guys, most yeshiva boys don't know the book of Job. They don't know it. Why? Because they think it's pronounced Job. Anyway, so why can't I legitimately say to the guy who's collecting money and say, go get a job, go get a job, learn the book of Eov and go get a job? Why can't I say that? Why would you say, what would you tell him? If I came to you and I asked you that question, Chuck, what would you tell me? It's a fair question, yes?
Tell him to go get a job again.
Okay, but is that the right thing to do?
Putting him on the right track.
What do you have to, well, I'll come back to that. I'll come back to that. You put him on the right track. You phrased it generically enough that I can work with it. That's good. Number one, the guy who says, I'm not giving you a handout, is working with a misconception. He thinks that that's his money. He thinks that he is the owner of that money. And therefore, he has the right to go tell somebody, I'm not giving you a handout. Please, go get a job. You are incorrect. You've heard me say this many, many, many times. Your money is not yours. It's not. It belongs to God. God is gracious enough to share it with you. But it's on condition. It's a conditional payment. You get to keep 90% of your earnings. Far better than Uncle Sam gives you. God says, I'll let you keep 90% if you give away 10%. That's the deal. So when someone comes to you collecting and there's a legitimate need, you have no right to say, go get a job, no handout. That's not your money. You're just a custodian over God's 10%. Go give it. You can't go ahead and do that. You can't just tell him that. It's not yours. You have to give back to God what's his. And who is that? You can't physically give it back to God. You give it to God's people, those who need it. That's how you deal with it. I love to quote this Mishnah from Pirkei Avos, from Ethics of the Fathers. The Mishnah says, ten lo mishelo, give back to him, capital H, from what is rightfully his. She'ata v'shelecha shelo, because you and what you have is really his. Give back to him what is his, because you and what you have are all his. That's the bottom line. I love that Mishnah. I love it because it puts it in perspective. Any gifts that we have, whether it's our monetary resources, and I'll go further, any of the skills and talents that we have are gifts. They are gifts from God. It is our obligation to use those gifts, whether they be monetary or otherwise, in the service back to God. That's what we are obligated to do. I'm sure I've told you this story. A fellow came into the Kollel that I used to work out in Columbus, and he's not a, by no means a wealthy man. And he came in and he said, I love to learn here. I love to study, but I don't have, I can give you $18. I can give you something just, you know, but I can't be one of your big donors. But I'll tell you this much. I was a CPA for many, many years. I'm more than happy to come in however often you want me to come in and make sure that your books are good. Your QuickBooks, your accounting software, that everything is done properly, filing the taxes and the forms. I will donate and volunteer my time. That's a skill that I have. I'm willing to donate it to you. That's exactly what this mission is telling us. You and what you have all belong to God. You go ahead and you use it. Okay. Let's take it a step further. Another reason why I can't go ahead and say, go get a job, no handouts for you, is because the wheel of fortune is constantly turning. One day you may be at the top, but there may come a time of where the tables will turn and you will be in need as well. Never, ever, ever think that you're going to always be at the stage you're on. Whether it's at the top level and you're doing extremely well and super successful, plenty of people have fallen from that high, from those heights down to much, much, much deeper, lower levels. And vice versa. If somebody's going through difficult, challenging time, don't think that your fortune can't change for the better. Don't be so quick to dismiss somebody who's on a lower financial level than you. You don't know what the next day will bring. Many of us, you know, we've all lived through financial economic downturns. They have tremendous impacts on people's lives. Don't be so quick, right? God says, listen, 90% of it, I will let you use, conditional upon giving the other 10%. I make the suggestion. How do you do it though? It's so hard. I think I've mentioned it in this class. I lose track. Did I talk about having another bank account? Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, that is the trick. It is such a great idea. All right, I'm not going to repeat myself then. But that's how you don't get so sucked into, well, it's my money and 10%. I'm in charge. Think of yourself as the trustee on an irrevocable trust. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's an irrevocable trust that pays out. Okay, maybe it's not irrevocable. But it is, it's a trust fund that you have the right as the trustee to dispense and to give out that money. It's so enjoyable. I love giving away money. I do. It feels so good. And I know I'm doing the right thing. Liz, you've been in my house. I get a knock at my door often, right? I'm telling you, I think it's, again, I get a knock at my door. It's very simple. I'm happy to welcome them in. I'm happy to pull out my tzedakah checkbook and I write a check. I see what the balance is. Done. Great. It's a simple concept. Okay. Let's keep going here. Why does God create poor people in the first place? Why can't we all just have enough money? Why do there have to be poor people? Do you ever think about that? Mm-hmm. Why can't God go ahead? He provides enough air for everybody. Air is, you know, that's why they say Jews have big noses, because air is free. Don't tell me you never heard that.
Never.
That's an old one.
That's old.
That's also why, you know, when Moses was coming down and God said, I'm willing to offer you the Torah in tablets. He said, well, how many tablets? Well, I'm sorry. They said, how much does it cost? God said, it's free. He says, good. We'll take two.
That I heard.
Sorry. But why? Think about it from a philosophical, from a theological standpoint. Why did God create the world that there are poor people? Why? Let everybody have enough. Yes, Fred.
Well, so that we could give, so that we could help the poor.
I got a better idea. Don't make anybody poor and make only 612 commandments. Everybody wins then.
I guess it's why the good and evil, the bad times, the good times. I guess there's you need the comparison.
Why?
You wouldn't know if things were good if they hadn't been bad at one time.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying everybody should be multimillionaires.
No.
They can still be hierarchies of people that are billionaires, millionaires, you know, and then everybody else below. But why do you have to have poor people? This is not my question. One of the greatest rabbis of all time, Rabbi Akiva, was asked this question. It's recorded in the Talmud. He was asked this question. But to appreciate the answer, let's take a step back again. When we talked about the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos, I'm sure I mentioned the fact that the ending of that paragraph, of talking about when God finished, I think we talked about it by Havdalah, when God finished all of creation, the terminology in the Torah is that God finished all of his work, and it ends with the word la'asot, to do. Did we talk about this? I think we did. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because on it he abstained from all his work which God created to make. It's not grammar. It's not proper grammar. You finish it by saying, because on it he abstained from all his work which God created, period. What do you mean la'asot, to do more? So we explained then, and we'll explain again, and that is God said, I'm stopping here. I created the universe up to a point. It's not complete. It's not finished. Now I'm handing over the reins, and I'm inviting you, human beings, I'm inviting you to be a part of it, the junior partner in my firm. Let's do this together. Tikkun Olam. Let's finish and bring the world to its completion. Yeah. Rabbi Akiva told this person who asked the question, and that is, God wants us to be his agents to complete the job of creation. So yes, he has to create needs. There needs to be something or someone that I can go ahead and do righteousness. Now, a legitimate question you can throw back at me and says, but why that guy and not this guy? Why does this guy have to suffer because I got to do the right thing? Candy, you were thinking that, I know.
What?
Right? Why does this poor guy have to be a poor guy just because Tachman has to give tzedakah so that he can make the world a better place? You know what my answer is? I have no idea. I don't work on God's accounting team. Why this person has that hand dealt to them, I'm not privy to that. I don't know the answer. Only God knows that answer. We as human beings, the most we can do is play the hand we're dealt. We don't get to choose the hand, but we play it. So why that particular person is born without the necessary needs and someone is born with even more resources, I don't know. That's part of God's accounting. I don't know. But that is what Rabbi Akiva said, right? We have a job to do. And when there are needs that have to be addressed, that's where we step in. Think about it. When we eat bread does not grow from the ground. Why? Why can't bread just grow from the ground? God can do it. It's no skin off his back, I promise. Because it's all part of the philosophy that I have to make the effort. I have to put in the effort to accomplish. That's what we need to do. Okay. More important, perhaps, than what you give is how you give it. This is really, really, really important. The Talmud says that a person can go ahead and give a coin for tzedakah, and he's blessed for that effort with six blessings. God blesses him with six blessings. If he goes ahead and he talks to the poor person, he appeases him, he encourages him, he uplifts him, he gives him some level of, I feel that I'm happy to help you in any way that I can. He makes him feel good about himself. He gets 11 blessings. Same coin. One guy gives it one way. He did his job. He did the right thing. He helped out a poor individual, gave him tzedakah. Good for him. Excellent. But the guy who goes ahead, there's a fellow in the shul that I daven in the morning. I'm amazed. Every single person that comes collecting during, you know, in the shul, he not only looks at that paper to make sure he's legit, he looks at it, gets the guy's name, sees what it is he's collecting for, and he actually talks to the guy. He says, Reb Shimon, I see you're collecting for, you're making a wedding. I want to wish you a mazel tov, and I hope that you're able to get all the funds necessary to marry off your daughter. Boom. And then the guy goes, he feels good. You treated him, as we've said many times, with dignity. A guy like me, the guy comes up to me, I pull out my wallet, I give him a dollar, and I keep going. I don't get into the conversation. This guy is great. He makes the person feel good about themselves. That's more than what's given. It's how it's given. But wait, because the truth of the matter is, and it's something Charles said, and I'm coming back to you now, Charles.
Okay.
You could have been Maimonides in another lifetime. Maimonides goes ahead and he talks about eight levels. The mitzvah of tzedakah is not a one level, you know, a one dimensional thing. You have a need, you give it, you give money to help the poor person, and you move on. He says there's different levels. In fact, he identifies eight levels. Each level that's higher than the next is where you preserve the dignity of the recipient more and more and more. So we'll start at the lowest level. The lowest level is where you give an amount, you give a proper amount, but it's somewhat grudgingly. Fine, I'll give it. Okay, I ask you the question. If a guy comes to me and he's collecting and I give him a dollar, right? Give him a dollar, but it's somewhat begrudgingly. Fine, I'll give it to you. Have I fulfilled the mitzvah? Yes or no?
Yes.
The answer is yes. I have fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah. I took of my resources and I shared it with someone in need. I've done the mitzvah. But that's like the lowest level, right? You make the person feel worse than he does already. That's, you did the mitzvah, but not in the best way at all. That's level eight. Level seven is maybe you give less than the proper amount, but you did it cheerfully. Instead of giving what I could have given a dollar, I give him a quarter, but I smile. Okay, fine. That's a little better. It's a little better. Next, number six, is where you give directly what you're supposed to when asked. Person comes up to me, presents his need to me, and I say, okay, I'm happy to give, reach into my pocket, and I give him a dollar. Okay, that's a higher level. What about the next one? What about... What do you think? What's one step above that?
Give it, but do it cheerfully.
No, we did that. We have it cheerfully already.
Give more and do it cheerfully.
No, not yet.
Without being asked?
Thank you. Exactly. What about my giving it before the person even had to ask me? I recognized the need and I made sure that he had what he needed before he had to ask. Because obviously asking for help is hard. It's not a natural thing. We don't like to ask for help. We think we can do it all by ourselves, and we don't like to ask for help. So if I see the need before the person has to ask me, I preserve their dignity even better. What about the situation of where the poor person knows who he's getting the money from, but the donor doesn't know who it's going to? There's some level of anonymity. That's an even higher level, right? If my neighbor comes to me and asks me for something, so he's embarrassed, I'm embarrassed a little bit because we know each other, right? But what if the poor person knows that donor X gave the money, but donor X didn't know where it went? He gave it to somebody who took care of it and it ended up in the poor person. That's a higher level of where you preserve the dignity. Higher than that is where the donor knows, but the poor person doesn't. The poor person has no idea. Higher than that, where neither knows. The donor and the poor person don't know anything. You know what a classic example of that is? Putting money in a pushka. You know what a pushka is?
Yes.
Pushka, we call a charity box. You know? That's a classic example. You don't know who gave it. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. You just give it, you know, you drop it off at the place and you say, have a great day. These are seven levels. The top level, says Maimonides, says the Rambam, the top level. Say it again, Chuck. Come on, Charles, tell me.
I didn't get that.
What did you say?
I don't remember. Starting on the left half.
Help the guy get a job.
Yep. Starting them on the right path.
Thank you. Now you're talking, because that is even better. It's not a free handout. What you've done is you've put them the ability for them to stand on their own 2 feet.
Yep. Call them to fish.
Says the Rambam, says Maimonides, that's the highest level of the tzedakah mitzvah. To go ahead and to get the person, help them get a job. Help them secure a loan. I believe that if you co-sign a loan of some sort that facilitates that person to be able to do what they need, that's part of this mitzvah. So they don't have to keep collecting. They can earn it on their own. But again, as I say so often, these mitzvos, when you delve a little bit deeper, you see how sensitive the Torah is to preserve the dignity of a human being. It comes down to that. Susan.
So that would also include at the highest level, either mentoring somebody to give them the skill to go get a job, or paying for them to get training.
Yep, absolutely.
Yes, okay.
Absolutely. Not even a question. Absolutely.
Rabbi T, yes. Can I share just a brief story? I'm hoping that some people on this call are familiar with a comedian named Buddy Hackett.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So Buddy Hackett used to come on to the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, for those that remember him, once upon a on an occasion. And one time he happened to share a story about his father. His father was an upholsterer in Brooklyn. And apparently he was there when there was a guy that came to rob the store at night. It was just the two of them in the store. And his father looked at this guy who was robbing him, and he didn't have any money anyways. And he what he ended up doing was teaching this guy to become an upholsterer. Right? The guy came to rob him, and he, instead of shooing him away or calling the cops, he taught him a life skill. The guy ended up becoming an upholsterer and made a life for himself.
There you go. That really is what it's all about. Now that's a very special and unique circumstance of how far he went with it. But the concept that if I have the ability to help someone get on their own 2 feet, whether it be a loan or a skill, a training to help them, making the networking connections, call someone. How often do we hear somebody wish that? Pick up the phone and call some of your contacts. Send an email. We know people. That's how you help others. That's the highest level of tzedakah. Now, within that, though, a legitimate question that I'm asked is, but I only have limited resources, Rabbi. How do I prioritize? How do I determine who should get what? It's a good question. It's a very good question. So obviously, your favorite rabbi goes first. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. There is a concept. Charity begins at home. You heard that expression? Mm-hmm. It is based on a true concept. From a Torah perspective, family is number one. That means to say, if God forbid one's family member needs help, they're impoverished, or they're down on their luck, or they need a job, whatever it is, that's number one in terms of where your contribution should go. It's not appropriate to go ahead and to support, as great as that organization may be, if your own brother is down on his luck. It's not appropriate. Family goes first. Your own city, your own neighborhood, your own area is also a priority because that's the Jewish community in which you live. That's the most appropriate. Then you can go ahead and then obviously if you have personal things, like for me, I still support the institutions that I went to or my wife went to that we benefited with our Jewish education. I don't necessarily live in that city, but they played a vital role. I will continue to support them. Those are considered what I'll call still part of our neighborhood. So family, neighborhood slash your own personal beneficiary that you benefited from. And then believe it or not, the city of Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, is up there in the high priorities. You say, really? The answer is yes. Maimonides and others talk about this, but in Halacha, the city of Yerushalayim is considered a high priority to help support the Jews who are there. I can venture a guess as to why that is, but I don't think it's a far stretch to know that Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, has always been the centerpiece of what of our religion and where we want to be. Those who have the good fortune of living in Jerusalem are living the way it's meant to be. Is it with the temple? No, not yet. Is it everything in terms of a Torah society? No, not yet. But living and supporting Torah and supporting people in the city of Yerushalayim is also a priority. Now, I don't want to run out of time here. There's a few other points that I really want to make. A beautiful idea. Typically speaking, a person cannot make deals with God. You can't make a deal with God. I know the joke is you make the deal with the devil. You cannot make deals with God. You cannot say, God, if I keep kosher, then I want you to, give me $1 million. You can't do that. There's no deal. You can't make deals like that. God, if you go ahead and, you're running late. If you make it that I make this plane, God, if you make it that I get this interview, God doesn't make deals like that. There's only one exception, and that's for tzedakah. Believe it or not, there's a verse in the book of Malachi, the book of the prophets called Malachi, right? Who says it outright, that you have the right. God says, ubechanuni na. Test me, please, God says. Test me, please, if I will come through. If you give what you're supposed to give, don't worry. You have my word, I will pay it back, and then some. That means you can give tzedakah conditionally and say, God, I'm giving this tzedakah so that so-and-so should get better. So-and-so should have success on their interview. So-and-so should, you can do that. You can do that. I try to teach my kids that if they have a big exam coming up, they should give an extra dollar to tzedakah that morning. Put a dollar in the pushka and say, Hashem, please let me have success on this test. You can do that. When it comes to tzedakah, you can make deals. You can barter. I can't make this stuff up, but God himself says you can do that. But sure. Listen to the beautiful hint or allusion to where this concept. You give and you get back when it comes to tzedakah. The Hebrew word to give, the root of it is natan, notain, right? Notain la yo'ef koach, the one who gives those who are tired, gives them strength. The word notain. When the Torah talks about giving, it says v'natnu, v'nasnu, and they shall give. Spelled. You ready? Write this down, Robin.
Okay. Vav,
nun, tav, nun, vav. Five letters. Vav, nun, tav, nun, vav. You're smart. You'll pick up on this very quickly. Watch. You ready? Watch my hand here. Vav, nun, tav, nun, vav. Vav, Nun, Tuf, Nun, Vav. It's same a backwards. Palindrome. The word v'natnu, and they shall give, is a palindrome. Means it's read the same way forwards and backwards. Because if you give, it will come back. How cool is that? Yeah, that's the concept. God says, you give my money to those who need it. Give tzedakah. Ah, you're going to be... Don't worry, God says. I promise you will get it back in spades. Even the word tzedakah, the concept is so beautiful. What happens? You take a coin in your hand, you extend your hand, and you put the coin, so to say, in someone else's hand, right? That's the four steps. I quoted to you early on that the giving of tzedakah is equal to all the mitzvahs in the Torah. Why? It's an important mitzvah. But what it does is it represents everything about God. In fact, the Talmud says similarly that the giving of tzedakah, fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah, brings the redemption even closer. The redemption that we daven and we pray for every day. Giving tzedakah brings it closer. How's that possible? Think of it this way. God's name, Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey. Right? Got me? Mm-hmm. The Yud is the smallest letter in the alphabet. Let's pretend that that's a coin. That's just a little coin. So you have a Yud, the little, say, the little coin in Hey. Hey is 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Your hand. The coin in your hand, the Yud in the Hey, stretches forth above and drops the coin into the other person's hand is the other hay. The act of giving tzedakah is combining the yud, coin, hay, hand, vav, the outstretched arm, vav, hay, into the other hand of the poor person. It's almost as if you're taking the two parts of God's name, the yud and the hay, combining it with the vav and the hay, bringing God's name fully into this world. That's what we pray for every day. We want God's name. God and God's name should be one. But wait, this wasn't cool enough. A rich man in Hebrew is called Ashir. Ayin, Shin, Yud, Resh. Ashir, wealthy. The numerical value of Ashir is 580. Trust me. The word for poor person is an Ani. Ayin, Nun, Yud. That's 130. Rich man, 580. Poor man, 130. If you go ahead and take from the rich guy and you subtract the poor guy, you know what you have? 450. 580 minus 130 is 450, which is the word tain. Tain means to give. The only way that you have that relationship between the rich guy and the poor guy is where he learns to give. That's where you connect the two, by giving. One more. Who qualifies to collect tzedakah? What if I, you know, I'm a millionaire. What if all of a sudden the stocks go down and now my portfolio is only worth $999,000? Am I eligible to collect tzedakah? What do you say, Sandy? Yay or nay? I am allowed? You think I am allowed to collect? I'm a flipping millionaire. Oh, just $1 short of a millionaire. I can go ahead and collect money? I don't think so. No. Sorry. I have to disagree with you on this one, Alan. No, you do not. The Mishnah actually identifies, and the Mishnah gives a hard and fast rule that if a person only has, and the terminology that's used is less than 200 zuz, that was the coinage back then. It was a certain amount of money, a minimal amount of money, what we would today call the poverty line, whatever it was. I don't know what it translates to in real terms, okay? But it's less than 200 zuz, you're allowed to collect money. If you're just below, That means, let's say I'm 199. I have 199 zoos to my name. I'm allowed to collect. Even if the one person I'm going to collect from is going to give me 500 zoos, I don't have to stop and say, well, now I'm over 200. I can't have it. If I'm below the poverty line, if I'm under the 200, I'm entitled to collect tzedakah. Isn't it fascinating that the word tzedakah, the numerical value is 199. The word tzedakah. Sadi is 90. Dalit is 4. That's 94. Kuf is 100. That's 194. And 194. And hey is 599. You're entitled to tzedakah if you're at the 199 or below. There are so many allusions, so many hints like this. But I want to end with one final concept. Two final concepts. It's so important that we learn this concept of giving. Again, I know it's a foreign concept that the giving, in fact, is your benefit. We generally are brought up to think that if I give of myself, I give of what I have, I no longer have it, and I am decreasing my resources. From a Torah perspective, when it comes to tzedakah, it's the opposite. The more I give of myself, the more I will get in return. That's the deal. The palindrome. Give, it comes back. There's a concept that, and I think we should do this when kids are very, very young, to teach them that to enjoy giving as much as they do receiving. I love this quote. Whether it's money, clothing, food, or just uplifting someone's spirit, the heart that gives gathers. The heart that gives gathers. That's what we have to teach ourselves and our children. In today's world, it's all about me, 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 me. What's in it for me? What can I get? Entitlement. It's such the mode of today's world. Not only blaming the young generation, we're all susceptible to this. We are brainwashed to think about this concept that if I give, I'm losing. It's not true. It's not true. How can we teach our kids, ourselves, to give rather than always expecting to receive? Simple things like making a bracha. When you make a bracha, you're acknowledging that God gave us something. Whether it's the food we eat, the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, it's an acknowledgement that I have been a recipient of goodness from God. That's what a bracha is. I acknowledge it. If you constantly become aware of that trait of God giving to us, we will show appreciation and we will naturally develop the nature of giving besides for receiving. That's what we have to work on ourselves. But let me finish with this last point. There's one other form of tzedakah that I didn't touch on. And maybe this is, Susan, maybe what you were referring to. When I go ahead and I teach somebody something, that is a form of tzedakah. No, it's not necessarily a monetary thing. And it's not even necessarily because they're going to use that skill to get a job. But giving of myself, my knowledge base to those who are impoverished on the topic. I'm using the terminology purposely. If I'm the wealth of information and the person I'm teaching is the impoverished one who doesn't have it, then my teaching them is tzedakah too. You see, this was novel to me in preparing for this class. Tzedakah is not only in the physical realm. It's even in the spiritual realm. I can give tzedakah when I teach Torah concepts. I share a Torah idea with others. I'm giving tzedakah. I am helping someone in need to know how to navigate life spiritually. Teaching Torah is tzedakah. I never thought about it in those terms, but it's really true. Do you remember years ago, we did a class on the olive bays? Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Some of you are still, you know, I say it and you start getting headaches. I get it. I understand. But the first four letters, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, we spent time talking about how the words, the letters, are actually words. Aleph, Bet means Aluf, Bina. Aluf means teaching or learning. Bina is wisdom. Then we paused and we talked about those two connected. And then we did Gimel Dalet, which stands for Gomel Dalim, bestowing kindness to those who are poor. The suggestion of this book that I was reading, the Sefer that I was reading that taught about this concept, is that the two go together, the two pairs. Aluf Bina, teaching wisdom, is the form of Gomel Dalim, bestowing kindness to those impoverished. They go together. How beautiful is that idea? It's not only Torah. If you have knowledge, and certainly most of us, all of us at this point, right? We're not young punks. We have wisdom to share. That's on us. That is what we have still plenty to contribute to society. We have things. Do you know, logically, it makes no sense. If you have a 25-year-old Torah scholar and an 85-year-old person who is not a Torah scholar, who should I give my seat to? Who should I stand up for with honor and respect? I should stand up for the 25-year-old Torah scholar. He's far more knowledgeable than the 85-year-old who knows nothing. The answer says the Torah is you're wrong. You stand up for the 85-year-old, not the 25-year-old. Why? Because the 85-year-old has something this 25-year-old, very great Torah scholar, the 85-year-old has an advantage. It's called life experience. It's called wisdom about life. That's something, no matter how much Torah knowledge the 25-year-old has, he doesn't have life experience yet. When we go ahead and we share things that can improve somebody's life who's missing something, that's a form of tzedakah. And you know what? The same rule that applied in the physical tzedakah of where my giving, it comes back in spades, it comes back and I become the greater recipient of the physical resources that I gave away. It's very true even in the wisdom world as well. The more I give out, the more I find that I receive. My ability to understand is even greater. My students who question and, you know, ask me, they sharpen even further. I'm more of the recipient than you are. The same formula that works in the physical realm of my giving of monetary tzedakah to others, it comes back to me. It is definitely true in the spiritual world as well. This is how I view it. Tzedakah, as we started, it's one of those top things that can change everything. Why? Because at the heart of the matter is I have something that, whether it's physical or spiritual, I am sharing it with others and improving their lives. What more can be more powerful that makes a statement to God that I still want to be here on earth? I still can make a difference. Maybe I didn't deserve it as much last year. I didn't earn it, but I will give tzedakah. I will give of my resources because I can help someone else out, whether those resources are monetary or otherwise. Giving of yourself to others is at the root of all of it. What all relationship between man to man is all based on. Giving of yourself to others. I say it, I will end with this. I'm sure I've shared it. When a baby is born, they're born with their hands closed. I confirmed this with an obstetrician. They're born very often with their hands, not clenched, but closed. One of the things that the Chevra Kadisha, the Jewish Burial Society, does when they prepare a body for burial is they try to make sure that the hands are open. And there's great symbolism in that, because there's no creature that is more closed and selfish unto itself than an infant. There's nothing more selfish. You're tired. It doesn't care. It's hungry. It's dirty. It's wet. It's fussy. It doesn't matter. It's all about me, 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 me. That's what an infant is, the most selfish creature on earth. However, the hope and the prayer is that a person who goes through life, and when they have finally finished their journey on this earth, we hope that we've learned to open our hands, to learn to give of ourselves to others. What beautiful symbolism. That, I believe, is really at the root of what this mitzvah of tzedakah is all about. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes, Robin.
There was, for the physical part of giving, there was the formula where God said, you know, that 90% and then 10% was what you have to save. How do you parlay that into the spiritual?
There also, I don't have to give more than 10%, so to say.
Put me on mute.
Right? My time. Rav Moshe Feinstein of blessed memory, one of the great sages who passed away in the 1980s, he was asked this question about what we call meiser, taking off a tenth, a tithe. Mm-hmm. He says, it's the same concept. He says, you should give a tithe of your time and resources. You're not obligated to give 50% of your time. You should give at least 10%. Same idea. Mm-hmm. In the spiritual realm, you should be giving of yourself. Doesn't mean you have to make yourself a shmata. You know, make yourself into a rag and you have no kocha, no strength to do other things. No. But we should be learning to give of ourselves to the best of our ability, right? For a guy like me, if I only gave, I wish I taught more than I do, right? But that's what I do. I have the ability at this point. I don't know if I'll forever be able to do that, but that's where I'm at. Right now, I give more than that because that's what I'm supposed to be doing and I can do it. That's my ability. I'm like the millionaire who gives out more than, you know, $18.
So 10% is minimum, but you can give more if you're able.
Correct. That's correct. Even in the monetary realm, they say a person shouldn't give unless they're truly, truly wealthy to a point of where it's not going to harm their own resources. Person should generally not give away more than 20%. Because you don't know what future is in store. Unless you're super wealthy like all of us. Yes, Sharon.
You kind of touched on this. I just had a question about like where we should give tzedakah. I mean, you kind of touched on it as like family first, this and that. But what about like just in every day when you're driving down the road and there's somebody on every street corner asking for help? Where do you?
It's a tough call. I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. It depends on how much tzedakah money you have to give out. And for me, I'm somewhat of a cynic, so I can't legitimately assume that everybody who looks the part needs it. Unfortunately, that's the world. There's unfortunately too many scam artists out there. Are there those that are legit? 100%. That I have no doubt. But I don't have the resources to make that determination. So sometimes I'll give, sometimes I won't. I don't even include that. To be honest with you, Sharon, the extra dollar or two that I pull out of my wallet, I don't even count it as part of my tzedakah money. It's something I gave, you know, it is.
Yeah. One of the things we used to do is when we had, our school was open, we had COVID. Kids could bring in lunch, but it had to be in a plastic bag. There was no lunch boxes and everything had to be pre-wrapped and they couldn't take anything home. So they were saying like, if they had, you know, anything that was non-perishable still couldn't be, we should just throw it away. I couldn't do that. So I used to take the bags of pretzels and the little containers of applesauce and Great. Stuff. I'd put them in different Ziploc bags. And every time I would be beautiful. Stopped at a corner, I would hand them out.
Beautiful. That's a beautiful idea. Beautiful.
So yeah, it was just killed me that I just watched them throw them beautiful. In the trash. But, yeah, there's just so much out there and you just
correct.
Don't.
Correct. And unfortunately it's triage. I wish we could help everybody, but
right.
You have to prioritize. It is what it is.
Right.
Fred.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually one thing that came to mind quickly was I heard that a long time ago, you give a man a fish, he eats for a day, teach him to fish, he eats for a lifetime.
Right.
But you said something but you said it two ways at one point. If I give, I did it a while back. Let's say I don't have the cash, but someone needs something that I'm trained to do, and normally they would pay for that service, but they need it, and I volunteer to do that for them. Is that a form of tzedakah?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. It's not a good tax deduction, but it's a good
interesting. I was thinking about something.
God keeps track of those things.
Well, I just thought of something that's coming up.
Brett, even that, you know, the dollar that I'm not even counting and I just gave it away. God didn't miss that. God did not miss that. You know, the Talmud says when it discusses things that happen, if you put your hand in your pocket and you want to pull out a quarter and you quote unquote accidentally pull out a dime, right? That trouble that you have to put your hand back in to go get the quarter, that was also something that now got calculated, that you had a little suffering, a little trouble in your life. You know, it cleanses the soul a little bit. Even something as little and minor as that, nothing escapes God's eye. So yeah, giving those extra pretzels and juice boxes and that extra help of training somebody, nothing escapes God. It all goes into that calculation, all of it. When we get after 120 years and we get up there, I believe that we will be very pleasantly surprised of things that we forgot about. Things we didn't even give to, you know, more than a passing thought that really helped somebody. I'll tell you this one story. Okay, and that's it. Great story. I saw this in a book. Rabbi Feldman wrote a book, and he tells the story about a gentleman who comes into his synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. Doesn't look the part of a member that he has in his synagogue. So it gets into conversation. He says he wanted to come here. Why? He wants to make a sizable donation. He said, obviously, I'm not going to turn it down, but why? He says, I went to Israel for the first time. And obviously, they told me I can't not go to Israel. I can't go to Israel and not go to the wall, to the Western Wall, to the Kotel. He doesn't know from prayers. He doesn't know from everything. So he's just standing back a little bit. And he's standing there. And he's just watching. And he sees one, what in I would call a Yerushalmi Yid, a Jerusalem Jew. And then he looks the part. He's got the long sideburns. And he's got the frock. And he's davening at the wall with such intensity and such feeling. And like, it was real. It was so sincere. And the fellow was moved. He really was so moved by it. He made up his mind that when he came back to Atlanta, he wanted to know what kind of place would a guy like that be a part of. So he researched it, and he came to Rabbi Feldman's shul. And he said, I want to give a donation. Why? Because that guy inspired me. I want more people like that, and I want to learn to do it fine. I promise you, this Yerushalmi Yid, this Jerusalem guy, he has no idea what happened in that story. The guy didn't go over to him and introduce himself and say, thank you for davening. Thank you for tea. He didn't say a word. So imagine the scene. After 120 years, this chassid is going to die. And he's going to go up. And then on his credit ledger is a big sizable donation to a synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. The guy never left Jerusalem. But on his ledger, he's got credit for $50,000 donation to a synagogue in Atlanta. He goes, Vos meint Atlanta? Vos is das? He has no idea what Atlanta is. But he gets credit for it. Why? Because he inspired that mitzvah on somebody's part. Do you know how many mitzvos we can be getting? How many credits we'll get? We don't even give a second thought to it. I am counting on the fact that we are all going to have a boatload of good stuff waiting for us that we probably forgot about. Just keep doing the right thing. Pay attention to it afterwards. Don't pay attention afterwards, but do the right thing. You'll be shocked how many people are benefiting. I was talking, here's another story. I'm not looking for any accolades here, but I was talking to a fellow who called me. We worked together in Columbus many, many years ago. And he called me before the wedding to wish me mazel tov. And we were reminiscing. And he reminded me that he and I secretly, we became aware of a family that was going to pull their child out of the local day school. They couldn't afford it anymore. And even with the scholarship help that they were getting, they felt they couldn't do it. So this fellow and I became aware, I don't remember how, and we called the office and we said, what's the difference between what the school is offering and what they need? So he and I, this fellow and I, decided quietly, nobody knew, we were going to pay the difference. We gave the school what the difference to make it that the kid can stay. And the kid stayed, I don't know how many years. We paid it forever. I totally forgot about this. I totally forgot. But he reminded me. Things like that, you can't imagine. Every little thing that you do to help somebody is not missed. It is recorded, and you will receive the apt and due reward. Yes, Robin.
A quick question, just because when you get who this is more of a procedural sort of thing. How you determine who gets what? First, you said the family, then you said city neighborhood would be the second priority. Does that include the synagogue, or where does that go in that list?
Yeah, yeah.
But would a synagogue be so family then synagogue?
Family number one.
Right.
Things that you get benefit from, which are the synagogues in your neighborhood, the other, Jewish institutions that you're a part of, things that you benefit from, that's level two. And then there's Jerusalem.
Okay.
So even if I don't benefit directly, but, you know, there's an orphanage somewhere in Jerusalem that they're collecting money, so I'll give something. It's not the top of my list. I don't give the vast majority towards it. I have more local, more things that I have a benefit from. So the vast majority of mine go in the first and second category.
Okay, gotcha. Because you originally said city neighborhood. I wasn't sure what you exactly meant because I was thinking synagogue, but then that could be wider city neighborhood.
No, so. But that's things that you're benefiting, direct beneficiaries of.
Okay. Does it have to be Jerusalem or can it be Yerushalayim or can it be Israel, somewhere in Israel?
No, Jerusalem has a special place. Not to say you can't give to other things. I'm not suggesting that those are the only three things you give for. You can give whatever right. you want. But in terms of triage, it's the 80-20 rule. I would devote 80% of my tzedakah money to those three categories. 20%, okay, I'll give to this, I'll give to that. Something I don't necessarily, but okay. Somebody I know asked me, so I'll help them out. I'm not going to write a $1,000 check for them. I'll write an $18 check or a $54 check. All right?
Thank you.
Wonderful. Great. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Next week, we're on. One second. Next week, we're on. I think it's the last one before Pesach, the 29th. Yeah, because the 5th already is too late. So that means next week, we're going to talk about something related to Pesach. I'm not telling you what room, Robin, but it'll be something. But we'll do something Pesach related, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Have a great week, everybody.
Bye-bye.